Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Michael Robinson. His work focuses on the protection and recovery of top predators like Mexican gray wolves and jaguars. He's been associated with the Center for Biological Diversity since its founding and joined the staff in 1997. Michael holds a master's degree in literature from the University of Colorado at Boulder and a bachelor's from the University of Texas at Austin. He's also the author of a well-reviewed book on the history of wolves in the United States called Predatory Bureaucracy, The Extermination of Wolves and the Transformation of the West. That's University of Colorado Press, 2005. Anyway, so first, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for being on the program.
Oh, thanks, Derek. I'm happy to be here.
The first question is, can you talk about what wolf populations might have been like prior to conquest, and then talk about this, as you so rightly call it, the extermination of wolves and the transformation of the West?
Sure. So a few years ago there was a genetic analysis of wolves in the United States that attempted to look backwards and answer precisely the question you're asking. How many were there originally? And the answer was something on the order of 2 million wolves in North America originally. So that's not based on historical accounts. It's based on looking at what variety of genetic diversity there is and what in wolves today and what proportion of the original genetic diversity it represents. So 2 million originally, and we certainly had wolf recovery in some parts of the United States in the last 20 years, but still we're talking about only a few thousand wolves now, so much smaller, different scale of magnitude.
And actually, before we go on, there's another question I would like to ask, which is just to sort of lay the groundwork, how many species of wolves are there in the U.S. now? There's what we call timber wolves or gray wolves. There's Mexican gray wolves. There's red wolves. Are there others?
Well, it's kind of an evolving science. And species, considered today, there's probably only two species that are universally recognized, the red wolf and the gray wolf. And some of the other animals, types of wolves that you mentioned, are in fact considered subspecies or even populations. And it's an evolving science. Back in the 1920s, the leading taxonomists of the day ascertained, based on measuring bones, looking at the morphology of animals in general, which includes coloration of their fur, and also looking at subtle variations in bone shape and dentition and things of that sort, they identified, using those kind of metrics, 24 different subspecies of gray wolves. Now, of course, since the 1920s, there's been tremendous advancements in all kinds of science, including the development of precise genetic techniques. And using those, scientists say there probably weren't 24 subspecies. There were gradations in wolf types and wolf sizes, and certainly in color of their fur and patterns and the like, but that they suggest that those gradations didn't rise to the point in which they represented different subspecies as often as those 90 years ago thought that there were. So they suggest now that there's five subspecies of gray wolf in North America. So the Mexican gray wolf is considered, back 90 years ago as well as today, considered one of those subspecies. It's the southernmost occurring gray wolf subspecies. Many others of the supposed subspecies that were identified so many decades ago are now have been sort of lumped by current scientists into other subspecies that they consider have a greater foundation to be recognized as subspecies. But there's no guide to what particularly represents a subspecies as opposed to a population. So there's different ways of interpreting different data, but there's no question there's a lot more information available to us today with genetic analysis. And in some respects, we're talking about differences that are at this point theoretical, because whether or not, for example, there was ever a separate subspecies called the Southern Rocky Mountain wolf, Canis lupus youngi. That animal no longer exists. It was exterminated. Whether it was a population of animals that was that could be characterized as part of a broader subspecies, or whether it was as seen so many decades ago as its own, it doesn't exist. So, in terms of recovery planning, what we know, you know, for the current era, for looking into the future, there were wolves throughout the entirety of the United States, and they did differ. There were adaptations to different types of environments, and in particular to different prey animals that the wolves were likely to be pursuing and feeding on. And in terms of where we go from the future, many of these places that used to have wolves could again have wolves. The habitat is still there. In some cases, even the habitat may have improved somewhat, which is certainly an uncharacteristic situation in the modern world, but there's been reductions in livestock grazing in some areas. There's been increases in prey animals that were hunted to extinction or near extinction 80 or 100 years ago. And so whether or not we have the precise same type of wolf, we know that wolves that were very closely related, for just to use the same example, could be reintroduced into Colorado and would serve their natural ecological function and, in general, keep the gray wolf species from going extinct again, or contribute to their resilience in the face of modern pressures. But I hope that overview is helpful.
Oh, that's really helpful. And it actually leads to, before we get to the extermination, that leads to another question, which is, you said a variety of prey species, and presume that most listeners are very sympathetic, but they may, you know, we hear, you know, sort of the propaganda is that that the wolf is going to eat Little Red Riding Hood and is going to basically kill every cow it sees and going to do all this other. Who do wolves eat naturally? And also, you said a variety. So, I mean, are there some wolves who are more adapted to eating, say, deer, and other wolves will eat chipmunks? I mean, I don't know myself.
Well, chipmunks might be part of the diet of some wolves, but they would be more in the category of hors d'oeuvres rather than a solid meal. So the thing that characterizes wolves altogether is that, first of all, I'm sure most of your listeners are aware, they're family animals, they're social animals. They go about primarily in groups that we call packs, and that aids them in their hunting of large animals, ungulates, hoofed mammals, which are really the bread and butter of all wolf types. And the smaller animals, certainly they will eat, but is not enough to sustain them, particularly because when you go about in a pack like that, you know, if you're able to kill, say, a northern type of wolf, moose, or even further north, caribou, or elk in many parts of their range, these are animals that take a lot of helping hands, or maybe it's helping mouths and paws to be able to bring down, and they're certainly not successful all of the time. In fact, it's a minority of the time in most instances, most circumstances, that they actually successfully kill an animal and can feed on it. But once you do, there's a lot of mouths to feed. There's a lot of hungry stomachs. And so if you're talking about a 600-pound animal, that's something that can feed a family group of wolves. If you're talking about a much smaller animal, as I said, that's really snack type food for an individual wolf rather than for a group. So they feed primarily on hoofed mammals. In the north, as I suggested, moose, caribou are some of the prey animals of wolves in the far north of our continent. And this goes well beyond wolves, but throughout many different types of wildlife, the further you get to the poles, the animals tend to be larger, have larger body size. That's in large part to conserve heat in the face of a cold climate. And the further you get to the equator, you have animals with somewhat smaller body types. So, for example, Arctic wolves are substantially, which at the northern end of their range in North America, are substantially bigger than Mexican gray wolves at the southern end of their range. And there's a gradation of wolf sizes and types in between. So on that southern end of the range, the Mexican gray wolf, which whose original range was conceived of back when there was a sense that there were far more subspecies than are generally recognized today. They were seen as occupying areas in the Sierra Madre of Mexico and in what's called the Sky Island ecosystem of the southern portion of southeastern portion of Arizona, southwestern portion of New Mexico, and a small portion of Texas as well. And in those ecosystems, there were few, if any, or in those landscapes, I should say, there was few, if any, elk. And instead, the wolves were thought to have preyed primarily on white-tailed deer, including a subspecies of white-tailed deer called Coos white-tailed deer, which is smaller than white-tails elsewhere. And they were also feeding on collared peccaries, which are also known as javelina. That's an animal that resembles a pig, but is actually not closely related to pigs, but is also typical of this sort of this arid environment in the Sky Islands ecosystem. Sky Island, by the way, is a term that refers to mountain ranges that rise out of a desert sea, if you will, just as if they were islands. And as part of that that landscape, there's various animals that live in each individual Sky Island mountain range that have not had a chance to because of the very differing ecosystem far down below in the desert, haven't had a chance to interact with others of their kind, and so they evolved individually and are different from others of their kind. But wolves are animals that travel between these different mountain ranges because they have larger ranges. So a long answer to a brief question. It depends on where they are and what they've evolved to eat, but they're all adaptable to an extent. And for example, Mexican gray wolves that have been reintroduced into areas north of their originally conceived historic range have fared quite well, primarily preying on elk.
Well, thank you for that. So let's talk about the extermination of wolves, or this culture's war on wolves. And you can approach it however you want. Do you want to talk about the present? Do you want to talk about give a historical overview? How would you like to approach that?
I think it is important to look at how we got to the present point. Wolves were seen as competition for humanity in the food that we've designated as our animals to eat, whether it's domestic livestock or wild animals such as elk and deer that are hunted for human food as well, but particularly the threat that was seen that was attributed to wolves to livestock led to institutional efforts to eliminate wolves from the landscape. At first, this took the place of bounties that were financed by stockmen's associations and in some cases counties and states. And this was seen as a necessity because during the much of the period of Western expansion of our civilization in the United States, the natural prey animals that wolves had depended on since time immemorial were eliminated or greatly reduced in almost the blink of an eye. So, for example, here in the Southwest, there was a subspecies of elk called Merriam's elk that was markedly different from other types of elk. And in 1906, the very last one was shot. And so for many decades, there were no elk in the Southwest because there were none left, and eventually they were reintroduced from Yellowstone National Park, a different type of elk that have done very well in the Southwest. But, of course, in the meantime, wolves had to eat something. And similarly with deer, with bighorn sheep. I think most of your listeners are probably familiar with the story of the bison, the great herds of buffalo that roamed the Great Plains in numbers up to tens of millions and were gunned down in a little over the course of a decade. There was increasing killing of them throughout the latter half of the 19th century, and in the 1870s, the bison that remained were almost completely eliminated. Only a very small herd survived in Yellowstone National Park and actually kept the plains bison from going extinct. So that was another example where the food that wolves relied on was eliminated in a very short period of time, and it was replaced very handily, perhaps from a wolf's point of view, by domestic livestock that were placed on the landscape. So, The conflicts ensued, and bounties were raised and paid out to provide a financial incentive for people who could kill wolves. The interesting thing about the bounty laws throughout the United States is that, and particularly in the western United States, they failed in their intended purpose to kill off all of the wolves. And that's because of how they were structured. They were an incentive that was paid out on a per-wolf basis, $1 or $2 for somebody who could prove that he killed a wolf or whatever the case. Maybe there were other animals as well that were bountied, but for which bounties were offered. But wolves were really the biggest target and considered the most important target. So when it was easy to kill wolves, people went about it with the gusto. When the wolves became very scarce, and when the remaining wolves became very cautious, it was less easy, and the effort wasn't necessarily worthwhile, and so that allowed wolves to persist and in some cases even to regain ground and numbers where they had been reduced. So in response to the failure of bounty laws, excuse me, my cell phone's got a sound of a loon there in the background, in response to the failure of the bounty laws, the U.S. government set up a wolf-killing program exactly 100 years ago, in 1915. And the advantages that they saw in that program was that people were not paid per wolf that they killed, but rather they were paid a monthly salary and were kept on the job even when wolves in the area to which they were assigned became very rare and hard to kill. And so they could focus on killing the very last ones and eventually managed to exterminate them. So there was a federal program that did the job where local incentives and state incentives were not sufficient. And it was carried out very ruthlessly to kill the very last one, no matter whether it was poison, lake hole traps, digging pups out of their dens and destroying them. The goal was to leave zero behind, and that's what they did throughout the western United States. The only wolves that survived this federal program were those in Alaska, where their livestock grazing was not extensive, and there was not nearly as concerted an effort to exterminate them, and a very small population in northern Minnesota in the Boundary Waters area that was and is so wet that extensive grazing of livestock was also impractical, and so a couple hundred or so wolves were permitted to persist there. And everywhere else in the United States, they were exterminated. And in 1950, after the wolves in the U.S. were almost entirely gone, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which was the agency that had carried out this program, began exporting it as a foreign aid program to Canada and to Mexico, and basically teaching people in those two nations how they could efficiently kill wolves, and providing American government-produced poison to facilitate that. And that led to poisoning of a lot of wolves in Canada, but the country was so vast it was impossible to exterminate them. A lot of other animals poisoned as well, weasels, wolverines, bears. And in Mexico, they were more successful, and they managed to kill all but a handful of wolves in the Republic of Mexico before the Endangered Species Act became a law in 1973.
And so can you bring this up to the present, where wolves are recovering in many places, but there is still there are still programs to kill them?
Yeah, so the passage of the Endangered Species Act, which was a Richard Nixon idea and pushed by his administration and signed by the president, at the end of 1973, it really reversed the old ethos that was written into government policy that we kill any animal that's inconvenient to us and we seek to exterminate their entire species. And instead it provided dramatically different marching orders, which is that we're going to take proactive steps to keep animals and as well as plants from going extinct, and not just to conserve those particular types of life forms, but much more broadly to conserve the ecosystems on which endangered and threatened animals depend. And that's that charge to conserve the ecosystems is actually the first stated policy or reason for the Endangered Species Act written into the law itself. So that led to some restrictions on killing The remaining wolves, which are very, very few, as I said, mainly in Minnesota, but there were still a handful of wolves that were crossing over the border now and then from Mexico, and it led to restrictions on pursuing those animals to kill. But it also led to recovery plans being written for wolves. So, for example, in 1980, there was a recovery plan written for northern Rocky Mountain wolves and was amended in 1987, updated, and it called for reintroduction of wolves into central Idaho and into Yellowstone National Park, and wolves were already returning from Canada into northwestern Montana, Glacier National Park, and surrounding regions. They were returning on their own, but it said we need to have three populations that are linked together with a minimum of 10 breeding pairs in each population for recovery. And this was based on science that, you know, back in 1980 and 1987 hasn't advanced nearly as far as science has today. Today, scientists are much more likely to believe that far more animals of any type, but especially wolves, not all of whom breed in any population, must be on the ground to ensure their long-term persistence. But those were very minimal goals that were set in the 1980s, as I said, for the northern Rocky Mountains, and led to reintroduction in 1995 of wolves in Yellowstone National Park and in central Idaho, and the growth of wolves in that whole region of the northern Rocky Mountains. Similarly, wolves were protected. They did not require reintroduction to increase in numbers. In the upper Midwest, I mentioned there were small numbers, a couple hundred maybe wolves in northern Minnesota. Well, that population was allowed to expand to include larger areas of Minnesota, but also the upper peninsula of Michigan and portions of Wisconsin as well. So that wolves in that population expanded both in distribution and in numbers until there's something on the order of 5,000 of those animals today. And in the Southwest, in 1998, the Mexican gray wolf was reintroduced to Arizona and New Mexico. So the upshot of it is that wolves have increased in numbers thanks to the passage of the Endangered Species Act, but in more recent years, there's been significant attacks on them, and in some cases, their numbers have been driven down as well, and perhaps even more troubling in the long run. There's been some gaping holes that have been that have been created in the Endangered Species Act due to political efforts to destroy the law and to destroy a lot of wolves.
So, what are some of those holes?
The most serious hole in the act, as I describe it, came in 2011. And if you can think back 4 years ago and recall, and your listeners can recall, the stand budget and also...
Wait, the phone crapped out for a second. So last thing I heard was 2011, your listeners may recall.
Yes. So 2011, your listeners may recall that there was a huge standoff between Congress and President Obama over the budget and over whether the United States was going to honor its debt and make payments to people who've counted on the United States creditworthiness for buying bonds and the like. So the Republican Congress was insisting they weren't going to pay their debts and they weren't going to approve a new budget. There's a big standoff. There were lots of negotiations. And as part of those negotiations, a rider was slipped into the omnibus bill, the bill that was going to cover all of the conflicts and actually allow us to pay our debts and allow us to have a United States budget. And the rider said, wolves in Idaho, Montana, eastern Oregon and eastern Washington, and northeastern Utah will be taken off of the endangered species list, notwithstanding any other law. So in a sense, it was amending this very successful law that's prevented the extinction of not just wolves, but so many other animals and plants that are vital to a living planet. The law was amended through a rider to create a wolf-shaped gaping hole in it, whereby wolves in this region were no longer protected under the Endangered Species Act. And that's really been a terrible blow to the wolves there, certainly in the 4+ years that since this rider passed, There's been about 2,000 wolves that have been killed, both through federal hunting, through mainly aerial shooting of wolves that are radio collared, or their pack mates that are found through following radio collared wolves, through federal trapping and snaring, strangulation snares, but also through licensed hunting, state licensed hunting, that has been very aggressive and has sought to drive wolf numbers down. So the wolf numbers have decreased since then. There were about 1,700 or 1,800 wolves in the population, in the bi-state population. Actually, it was a little less than that, because that number includes wolves in Wyoming that were not taken off the endangered species list. And the numbers have gone down, not sharply yet, but sadly the state of Idaho is gearing up to reduce numbers much more, and the state of Montana as well. So there's been big losses in wolves there, lots of wolves killed under, frankly, very inhumane conditions, many of them. And also this precedent set that the Endangered Species Act can be amended through a rider that removes protections from animals that are still, from a scientific point of view, still imperiled. And the threat of that continues even this fall. There's several bills that have been introduced in the Congress, and some of the sponsors have explicitly stated their intention and desire to have these bills incorporated in a massive omnibus bill that would fund the entire federal government this year. And those bills would take various populations or various states that now have wolves and exempt them from the Endangered Species Act in terms of protecting those wolves. So the biggest threat is to wolves in Wyoming and in the Great Lakes states. Both Wyoming and the Great Lakes states, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has repeatedly sought to take them off of the endangered species list through the process that the Endangered Species Act lays out. But that process includes safeguards to ensure that politics don't intervene and that the decisions are made truly on a scientific basis. Well, since the science, when you look at it closely, does not actually support removing these wolves from the endangered species list, federal judges have repeatedly struck down these administrative delisting moves, and in response, members of Congress, perhaps even with tacit support from within the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, have sought to bypass the safeguards and the scientific standards of the Endangered Species Act and do what they did back in 2011, just remove them by congressional fiat through a rider. That would, of course, have no debate. It's not like it would. Such legislation goes through the normal committee process where you can have expert witnesses who can weigh in and you can modify a law or even decide it's a bad idea. This thing just gets slipped into the bill that, you know, funds everything and gets very little scrutiny. So that's a real danger coming up that's based on the very unfortunate precedent from 2011.
And just a sort of a cynical comment. Have you noticed that so often it seems that the people who want to kill things put in those riders a lot more effectively than the people who want to save things? I don't hear about many really great environmental riders getting snuck through, but you know, we've got the salvage rider, we've got all sorts of riders we can talk about that have been just disasters that have been amended to something completely irrelevant to the topic at hand.
Well, I think that's probably correct, though I have to point out one very fortunate rider, but it's not a recent one. That was in the late 1890s, the rider that created that reserved the land that we now know as national forests from being privatized actually gave the president the authority to set aside national forests. But in the modern era, I think you're right. I think there's been very few instances, if any, that I can't think of any at the moment, where a rider to safeguard the nature, endangered species, wild places, has gotten through, whereas so many riders that undo protections have, in fact, gotten through.
I want to talk for a second about the claim oftentimes. Well, I'll just ask you. What is the claim? What is their claimed reason for having to kill these wolves? Having, in quotes, to kill these wolves.
Well, the livestock industry has been unalterably opposed to wolves from the outset. It was on behalf of the livestock industry that the U.S. government exterminated them. The livestock industry used every trick in the book to try and prevent reintroductions of wolves, to try and weaken protections of them under the Endangered Species Act, and of course to circumvent the Endangered Species Act and massacre them as they successfully did in 2011 in the Northern Rocky Mountains. So, you know, it's there's really a lot of political clout that the livestock industry has been able to throw at this, and you know that's the genesis of it. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to point out that to listeners that a lot of these people who are complaining, a lot of these livestock owners who are complaining, are first they're grazing their livestock on public lands, and second, a lot of these people who are complaining, there are programs in place that if they actually lose a cow or a sheep to wolves, they get paid for it. In fact, if it's a confirmed kill, I believe in the state of Washington at least, they get paid double value. So from a purely financial perspective, you know, honestly, if I were raising cows on public lands and I was getting paid double market value for every cow, I'd be like saying, come here, wolf, come on. You know, I'd be trying to encourage it simply because you're going to make a lot more money than getting market value. So the point is, it's not, unless I'm misunderstanding all this, it's not even purely financial.
Well, I think you raise a very good point. There's, you know, like everybody else, owners of livestock have ideological motivations, and that has turned out to be almost uniformly opposition to predators. And sometimes the amount of money that they might get in reimbursement is, you know, takes a secondary stance to their strong feelings of opposition to wolves. And as you say, it's the public lands. There is public money as well as private money that has been used to indemnify and reimburse the few people who have lost livestock to wolves. But in some cases, people just feel very strongly, and their ideology dictates their stances more than the finances do.
Do you actually know numbers? I want to be clear when I'm asking for these numbers. I am not sympathetic to the livestock industry at all, but I want to get the numbers out there if you've got them. Do you know how many cows or sheep are either confirmed or likely kills by wolves every year in the American West?
I mean, I don't have those numbers in front of me, but I can give you scales of magnitude in those numbers.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah. Is it 10 or is it 100 or?
Well, it certainly depends on where, you know, in different areas. There's different wolf populations, and there's different efforts that, you know, or in some cases no efforts to prevent depredations, to proactively through keeping wolves and livestock apart. In general, and you can get this from the Department of Agriculture, maintains a set of statistics. In general, it's a fraction of 1% of the livestock deaths can be attributed to wolves. In fact, it's a very, very small number. I don't have it in front of me, but I want to say something on the order of 1 or 2 or 3% that are of livestock deaths in the American West are attributable to predators overall. In many instances, what you have is feral dogs that are responsible for the most of them. Wolves are just a tiny, tiny fraction of that. So in terms of absolute numbers, again, it varies from year to year and certainly in place to place. We're talking about, you know, in some cases, some years in the Mexican gray wolf reintroduction program, you could count the livestock depredations on one or two hands. In other cases, it's gone a little bit higher. One of the interesting things is there's actually a correlation. I live in New Mexico right by the recovery area for the Mexican gray wolf, so I follow it very closely for the Center for Biological Diversity. And one of the interesting things was a correlation, an inverse correlation between the number of wolves that were removed from the wild, supposedly in response to depredations, largely actually in response to just political pressure from the livestock industry, and the number of livestock that were killed in subsequent years. And so counterintuitively, what we found is that when the federal government was very aggressively going after Mexican wolves, gunning them down, trapping them on behalf of the livestock industry. This is, you know, post-reintroduction. We're talking about this century. That each year that it did this, several years in a row, the number of livestock that they, that ranchers claimed had been killed by wolves went up. So the more they killed, the more wolves they killed or trapped, the more the remaining wolves would prey on livestock, according to these statistics. And that when the federal government, thankfully, laid off killing and removing wolves for a few years, they're now back at it, because they were doing it so aggressively that they were really, they were driving the population down multiple times, and the population was never able to really, you know, use a phrase to get itself on its feet. So when the Fish and Wildlife Service finally gave the wolves a break, the number of depredations on livestock went down, which suggests that there's a lot that could be done when the motivation is there to actually prevent wolves from preying on livestock. And that when ranchers saw that livestock depredations led to more wolves being destroyed by the federal government, they really took much fewer measures to protect their stock, because as you point out, they were being reimbursed very generously, and still are, for the actual depredations. So there's no real loss to them. But if a depredation takes place, they can persuade the federal government to remove the wolves, which was happening. And just to zero in on one specific case, there was an article, I think it was in 2007, in High Country News, that documented that a one of the largest ranches, it was actually at the time owned by a billionaire from another nation, who had multiple investments, not just in livestock, but in mining and real estate throughout the world. When one of these ranchers' employees was engaged in actually trying to encourage wolves to kill livestock for that reason. And he made that statement very forthrightly to High Country News, that he had brought a cow that was about to give birth to very close to a wolf den, and left her there. And the first night, nothing happened. And the next night, apparently, shortly after she gave birth to a calf, the wolf, I mean, she, you know, this animal was brought up to within, I think it was within half a mile of a wolf den, which is really, really close, and was branded there, which this ranch employee suggested, because branding an animal involves searing its flesh, and it suggested could create a an olfactory lure to the wolves. The next night, the cow and her newborn calf were killed by wolves, and then the U.S. government came in and destroyed the wolf pack, which was exactly the intent of the ranch employee in bringing the cow directly to the wolf den. So this is this one illustration that was actually documented, shows perhaps some of the mechanism by which wolf depredations on livestock went up the more the federal government was happy to and went about and destroying wolves, and went down when the federal government exercised a little more prudence and gave the wolves a little bit of a break and allowed them to stay out there.
Well, thank you for that. And I want to point out also that if you're in almost any business, you're going to have, I mean, any time you have less than 1% losses, it's not really worth going to the government about. You know, I used to be a commercial beekeeper, and you're going to have, I ran about 300 hives, and, you know, you're going to have losses. And if I only lost 1% of my hives, if I lost 3 hives, I'm not going to go to the government about that. That's nuts. You know, if you run a shoe store, if you lose 1% through stuff getting destroyed in the mail, you know, it's not the end of the world. It's a 1% loss, and they're actually, that makes clear to me that the economic motive is only part of it, because that's completely nuts to make federal legislation about something that's less than a 1% loss.
Yeah, and I think it's a good point. And as you pointed out earlier, of course, many of these stock are grazed on public lands, where there should be a little bit more care for the public values involved, including the wildlife, and you know, the sense that the federal government owes a certain industry a living is, you know, I mean, certainly there's always been industries that have sought federal favors, federal subsidies and the like. But in the case of the Western livestock industry, it seems like a large portion of the game plan is being supported by taxpayers from all over, whether it's free fencing material, which certainly doesn't aid other wildlife to string barbed wire fences up, but it helps with ranch management, or with development of water sources to aid livestock distribution, or killing off the predators, and many, many other instances. People from all over the United States are paying the cost of that. And in some instances, I think that's allowed the livestock industry, using the Western public lands, to develop a sense of entitlement that really they, you know, and in fact, in some cases, an insistence that what we all know of as the public lands are not public at all. And you have extreme cases such as Clive and Bundy in Nevada essentially declaring that these lands are private lands, contrary to every Supreme Court precedent and laws that have been passed. And that happens here in New Mexico as well and other places. So when you have that sense of entitlement that the world owes you a living, people can get very insistent in trying to badger the government when it seems like it's not doing 100% in serving one's bidding.
So we only have like 5 or 6 minutes left, and we've talked about the first half of the title, the extermination of wolves. We haven't talked about the transformation. And I want to tell you really quickly about a friend of mine who teaches at a college or university in Binghamton, New York. And there's a big struggle going on there because there's a college forest that is being slowly destroyed because there's so many deer. And the college doesn't want to cull the deer because animal rights activists would protest too much. And the point is not the animal rights activists, and the point is not even the college, but the point is that the forest is being destroyed because there's too many deer. And there are too many deer because dot, 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 now you take over. And that's...
Well, yeah. I mean, in the case of the East, not only have the wolves been exterminated, but except in South Florida, where the Florida panther is barely hanging on at the far southern tip of Florida, the pumas or cougars or mountain lions, all the same terms for the same animal, have also been exterminated. And so, as you know, in the East, you've got these huge deer numbers. You've got saplings of native trees that never grow beyond a few inches before the deer discover them. And you've got a complete transformation of the forests, and a lot of loss of the diversity of eastern forests as well. Now, there's been studies in the western United States of the effects of bringing wolves back that allow us to look into what were the effects of having removed them in the first place. And it's very instructive. First of all, as your example from New York there indicates, the vegetation can be drastically changed. So, for example, in Yellowstone National Park, when wolves were returned, the elk had not faced any wolves for many decades, and they had been accustomed to being down in the stream bottoms, eating the saplings of willows and cottonwoods and alders and all these streamside trees that are also make good eating for elk. But in the areas where there's low visibility because there were bluffs that kept the elk from seeing any approaching wolves, the elk learned that these were dangerous places, and they stopped frequenting them after wolves were reintroduced into Yellowstone National Park in the 1990s. And so in these areas, you've had this proliferation of streamside forests, cottonwoods and alders and other trees that have grown up because the elk are no longer browsing every single sapling that comes up. And those trees now support songbirds, migratory songbirds that are nesting in them. Beaver cut down some of the trees for dams. The dams that beavers create over the years slowly tilt in and create meadows that are liked by other animals such as elk. And before they silt in, they're good habitat for fish. So the whole ecology of the stream sides in portions of the northern Rocky Mountains have been improved and brought back to what they presumably were like, and in some cases we have records were like, prior to the extermination of wolves. And it gives a extent of the damage that's been that was done with wolf extermination. But it's not just the plants and the animals that depend on them directly. A study in Grand Teton National Park, directly south of Yellowstone, showed that pronghorn numbers, known as pronghorn antelope, had increased when wolves were brought back. And that sounds counterintuitive until you realize that the coyotes were the main killers of pronghorn fawns. Pronghorn are, of course, very fast animals. They're the fastest land mammal in North America. So neither a coyote nor a wolf nor almost anything else is capable of chasing down an adult pronghorn and killing it to eat it. But the pronghorn fawns, of course, are not that fast. So coyotes have been focusing on killing the pronghorn fawns for their food. Wolves certainly would opportunistically kill a pronghorn fawn if they stumbled on it, but because, as I said earlier, wolves go about in larger family groups and they're larger animals than coyotes, a pronghorn fawn is not going to be a full meal, and so they didn't focus on them. What they did do is kill coyotes that they saw as essentially competitors, just as, you know, two dogs each claiming a territory might fight. So wolves regard coyotes as interlopers in their territory, and they kill them. They certainly haven't eliminated all the pronghorn, all the coyotes, but they reduced the numbers enough that the pronghorn got a break. And so with fewer, with more fawns surviving to adulthood, the pronghorn population in Grand Teton National Park made a switch from a long-term decline in numbers to an increase in numbers thanks to wolf reintroduction. And there's other instances as well. In the Midwest, snowshoe hares increased in areas that had wolves for exactly the same reason. The coyotes were focusing on the hares. The wolves didn't bother us so much, but they were killing coyotes, and they gave the hares a respite. So there's many, many interactions. There's animals that are benefited from the wolves' leftovers. When wolves kill a large animal and don't eat all of it, there's meat that's left over that everything from weasels to bears, badgers, to eagles, and many others can scavenge on, and that increases their opportunities to survive, say, a cold winter. Many, many other interactions that demonstrate to us how much we lost when wolves were exterminated, how much we've gained in the few areas where they have made significant ground towards recovery, and how much more we still have to do to restore not just this one important animal, the wolf, but also the ecosystems, the dynamics between animals and plants that they helped maintain over broad areas.
In general, I am extremely pessimistic about the future, but one thing that makes me very, very happy is I live in far northern California, and there is a wolf who has crossed over, and the first wolf that I know of in California for a long, long time. And there's wolf pups over in Coos Bay, which is a couple hours north of here along the coast of Oregon, and in that area. And the point is, so for the last 2 minutes, I would like for once to end on a positive note. I know a lot of environmentalists do that all the time. I don't. But can you tell me what would be sort of a realistic best-case scenario for wolves helping to retransform the West? So they are barely in California now. So let's say it's 15 years from now. You know, global warming has not killed the world, and, you know, things are – give me a best-case scenario for wolf re-expansion.
Well, the good news is that wolves, as you suggested, in talking about the wolf pack that's now established in Shasta County, northern California, the good news is that wolves can make it if they're given a break, if we don't set traps for them, if we don't shoot them. They know how to survive, and there's still really good wolf habitat, including abundant prey, in so many parts of the American West and in the East as well. So we do have a program, the Center for Biological Diversity, to protect the wolves in the Pacific Northwest, including Northern California, and that's led in part to the state of California providing protection under its state endangered species law to wolves that are riding there. We could see continued expansion of wolves. We could see the benefits that they provide to the ecosystems arrive in new places. But what it's going to take is keeping the wolves on the endangered species list, and first and foremost, preventing passage of a rider this year, 2015, that could take the wolves off the endangered species list in additional areas, such as the upper Midwest, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Wyoming, so that the natural expansion can continue, and not just in the Pacific Northwest, in northern California and Oregon and Washington, where wolves are starting to get a real foothold, but also, for example, Colorado, which had wolves, of course, as other states did also, were exterminated, and now wolves have started coming back down from Wyoming since the reintroduction in Yellowstone 20 years ago. But none of them have survived long enough, and certainly there's no population of wolves in Colorado. So if we can keep them on the endangered species list, then the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service will be required to develop a national wolf recovery plan that addresses all the places that could support wolves, that should support wolves, that would really provide for their long-term survival in the face of all the changes that are taking place and will take place in our natural environment. And so that really would be a best-case scenario, is much broader distribution of wolves, contributing to the balance of nature, the health of ecosystems, contributing to the economies and the social vibrancy of many communities, such as, just as an example, Yellowstone. People come there in large part to experience a landscape that has been reinvigorated by the recovery of wolves there. And that can happen in a lot more places, but it's going to take vigilance on the part of citizens who care about nature to prevent the politicians from stripping the protections for wolves.
And so I guess I do have one last question, which is, so what can people do to help prevent these sorts of riders? What can an individual do, or a group of people do who care about them, who live in Minnesota, Michigan, Colorado, wherever? What can we do?
Well, the most important thing is that you can make 2 phone calls, and you can also, if you have a chance, talk to your members of Congress face-to-face when they're in the district. One phone call, or maybe 3 or 4, should go to each of your United States senators, one to your member of Congress, and one to the White House, urging no riders that would remove protections for wolves or for that matter, other endangered species, because now many species are being targeted by these riders, urging President Obama to veto any budget bill that includes such riders, and urging members of Congress to use what clout they have with their colleagues and with the White House to do that, to prevent these riders from being inserted in the first place. So that's something everybody can do, and probably is the most important thing to ensure that wolves don't get exterminated a second time.
Well, thank you so much. I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Michael Robinson. This is Derek Trenton for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.